Chapter 6, The Way of Non-Duality. So Manjushri and Vimalakirti confront each other in Vimalakirti's empty house in Vaishali. In front of an audience of thousands upon thousands of bodhisattvas, arhants, gods and goddesses, they discourse profoundly on the sickness of bodhisattvas and living beings, on the nature of emptiness, and on the domain of the bodhisattvas, where all extremes, all dualities, are transcended. The entire company is spellbound by their eloquence. In fact, in 8,000 gods and goddesses, the bodhicitta, the will towards supreme perfect enlightenment for the sake of all living beings, is awakened. And yet, at the beginning of Chapter 6, The Inconceivable Liberation, our friend Shariputra has a problem. There is now an immense crowd in Vimalakirti's house, but all the furniture has disappeared. Where is everybody going to sit? After all, Shariputra is perhaps thinking, according to ancient Indian etiquette, no guest of whatever kind should be kept standing. Bodhisattvas and arhats should certainly not have to remain standing while Vimalakirti is lying on his couch, even though he is sick. As we know, Vimalakirti has the disconcerting faculty of telepathy. Knowing Shariputra's thoughts, he puts to him a rather pointed question. Reverend Shariputra, did you come here for the sake of the Dharma, or did you come here for the sake of a chair? Well, you can imagine Shariputra's feelings. He very humbly replies, I came for the sake of the Dharma, not for the sake of a chair. But Vimalakirti continues, saying, Reverend Shariputra, he who is interested in the Dharma is not interested even in his own body, much less in a chair. And, no doubt to Shariputra's great embarrassment, he presses the point home, carrying on in this vein for several paragraphs. But Vimalakirti's initial question gives us quite enough to think about. We may be tempted to smile at poor old Shariputra. Here we have a great assembly of bodhisattvas, arhants, and all sorts of extraordinary beings. The wise elder Vimalakirti and Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom himself, have just had a discussion of tremendous spiritual significance. Everybody has been highly delighted and uplifted by it, and they are all wondering what is going to happen next. And Shariputra starts worrying about chairs. But if we find Shariputra's behaviour a source of amusement, we should also be able to look at our own behaviour for further amusement, because this little incident warns us against a danger to which we are all liable, the danger of getting sidetracked. Say we attend a meditation class, or a lecture on the Dharma, or perhaps even go away on retreat into the depths of the countryside. We may get quite deeply absorbed in our meditation, or engaged in the lecture, or immersed in the retreat experience, but sooner or later our attention wanders. We start wondering when the tea and biscuits are going to appear, or whether a certain attractive person we saw last week will be there, or whether the central heating is going to be turned up. We might well ask ourselves the kind of question that Vimalakirti asked Shariputra. Did I come for the sake of the Dharma, or did I come for the sake of the tea and biscuits? Did I come for the sake of the Dharma, or for the sake of seeing that attractive person? Did I come for the sake of the Dharma, or for the sake of the central heating? There is nothing easier than to get sidetracked in this way, to succumb to the gravitational pull of the conditioned. We have a deeply ingrained tendency to be over-concerned with the mundane, the trivial, the everyday, at the expense of our spiritual development. In a word, to be over-concerned with comfort. Before we move on, it is worth bearing in mind that the Shariputra who appears in the Vimalakirti Nidesha is not the same figure as the relatively historical Shariputra, or rather Sariputta, that we encounter in the pages of the Pali scriptures. Historically, Shariputra was one of the two most prominent disciples of the Buddha Shakyamuni, the other being Mahamudgalyayana, and he was renowned as the wisest teacher of the Dharma after the Buddha himself. But in the Mahayana sutras, he came to represent the narrow, rather literalistic attitude which had developed in some Buddhist circles, and which the Mahayana tried to correct. We should therefore bear in mind that the Vimalakirti Nidesha uses the figure of Shariputra, both here and in several other places, in an imaginative rather than a historically factual manner. As Thurman puts it, perhaps rather crudely, he is used as a fall guy to express the limited Hinayana view so that it can then be exposed by the Buddha or by Vimalakirti or some other bodhisattva. He also seems liable, as in this particular instance, to be prey to petty and mundane anxieties. So Shariputra is worried about chairs. All right, Vimalakirti gives him chairs. 3,200,000 of them. And they're not ordinary chairs, but lion thrones, brought by Vimalakirti's magical power from a distant Buddha land in the eastern direction, whence, according to Manjushri, the best lion thrones come. And all these thrones fit into Vimalakirti's house without crowding. It seems to grow to accommodate them. And not only the house needs to grow, all the thrones are 3,400,000 leagues high, and the visitors have to be helped to enlarge their own bodies so that they can take advantage of these unusual seating arrangements. Perhaps not surprisingly, the arhats have more difficulty than the bodhisattvas, but this is soon overcome. Shariputra remarks how astonishing the whole business is, and this gives Vimalakirti the opportunity to explain the inconceivable emancipation, the state of emancipation in which a bodhisattva, through comprehending fully the relativity of space and time, can bring about all sorts of magical transformations. In chapter 7, entitled The Goddess, Shariputra is in trouble again. First of all, though, Manjushri asks Vimalakirti how a bodhisattva should regard all living beings. And Vimalakirti replies in a series of beautiful similes which illustrate how a bodhisattva should regard beings in order to realize that they are ultimately selfless or insubstantial. They are like the reflection of the moon in water, the sound of an echo, a flash of lightning, a face in the mirror, and so on. But if a bodhisattva considers all beings in this way, Manjushri wants to know, how does he generate love towards them? And Vimalakirti speaks very movingly about the nature of the loving-kindness, the metta, that the bodhisattva feels. After this poetic exchange, there follows another vigorous dialectical debate between the two bodhisattvas. At this point, a certain goddess appears. She lives, apparently, in Vimalakirti's house, and she is so delighted with the teaching she had been hearing that she showers the whole assembly, the arhats, the bodhisattvas, everybody, with flowers. In the case of the arhats, who, being monks, are not supposed to decorate themselves, the flowers become uncharacteristically and embarrassingly sticky. Despite his best efforts to brush them off, Shariputra remains spectacularly adorned. The goddess explains that the flowers do not stick to the bodies of the bodhisattvas because they, the bodhisattvas, have no attachment to discriminative views and thought constructions. This leads to an exchange of views in which Shariputra, as usual, comes off worst, and he is at one point completely lost for words. A little later on, he finds himself still more embarrassed when, to make a point about the relativity of manifesting as a man or as a woman, the goddess causes him to undergo a change of sex. First of all, he changes from male to female, which is bad enough in his opinion, and then from female back to male, which is even worse. I'm making fun of Shariputra here, but the point is that undergoing a sex change from male to female really should have alerted him to the relativity of gender. But instead of becoming androgynous as a result of this experience, he remains within the dichotomy of gender. So when he returns to his original gender, he still hasn't really learned anything. This incident has a rather modern ring to it, of course, in an era where having a sex change in a literal sense is possible. From a spiritual point of view, I doubt very much whether having a sex change would help anyone to transcend the dichotomy of gender. Those who have had such an operation often seem to have the experience of feeling trapped by it. Such changes represent alternation, not integration. Spiritually speaking, what is important is for a man to incorporate the so-called feminine psychological qualities, and for a woman to incorporate the so-called masculine ones, in addition to those proper to one's own physical come psychological gender. This would be true androgyny, for which there could never be an operation. The surgeon might be able to make someone a hermaphrodite, but they could never make anyone genuinely androgynous. Shariputra's double sex change happens in the space of a few minutes, and the chapter ends with Vimalakirti praising the goddess as an irreversible bodhisattva. Chapter 8 is entitled The Family of the Tathagatas, that is, the Family of the Buddhas. Replying to yet another question from Manjushri, Vimalakirti explains, in his usual highly paradoxical fashion, how the bodhisattva follows the way to attain the qualities of the Buddha. Vimalakirti himself then puts a question to Manjushri, asking him what is meant by the expression Family of the Tathagatas. Manjushri's response is also highly paradoxical, and it is praised at some length by Mahakashyapa. Following this discussion of families, a bodhisattva called Sarvarupa Samdarshana, or Universal Manifestation, then asks Vimalakirti a whole string of questions about his own family. Householder, where are your father and mother, your children, your wife? Remember that Vimalakirti is lying there on his couch and nobody else can be seen. Your servants, your maids, your labourers and your attendants. Where are your friends, your relatives and your kinsmen? Where are your servants, your horses, your elephants, your chariots, your bodyguards and your bearers? Vimalakirti replies to this typically Indian inquiry in a long series of beautiful verses, over 40 of them. They last until the end of the chapter and comprise the longest verse passage in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. Here, just to give a taste of them, are the first 12. Of the true bodhisattvas, the mother is the transcendence of wisdom. The father is the skill in liberative technique. The leaders are born of such parents. Their wife is the joy in the Dharma. Love and compassion are their daughters. The Dharma and the truth are their sons. And their home is deep thought on the meaning of voidness. All the passions are their disciples, controlled at will. Their friends are the aids to enlightenment. Thereby they realize supreme enlightenment. Their companions, ever with them, are the six transcendences. Their consorts are the means of unification. Their music is the teaching of the Dharma. The incantations make their garden, which blossoms with the flowers of the factors of enlightenment, with trees of the great wealth of the Dharma, and fruits of the gnosis of liberation. Their pool consists of the eight liberations, filled with the water of concentration, covered with the lotuses of the seven purities. Who bathes therein becomes immaculate. Their bearers are the six superknowledges. Their vehicle is the unexcelled Mahayana. Their driver is the spirit of enlightenment, and their path is the eightfold peace. Their ornaments are the auspicious signs and the 80 marks. Their garland is virtuous aspiration, and their clothing is good conscience and consideration. Their wealth is the holy Dharma, and their business is its teaching. Their great income is pure practice, and it is dedicated to the supreme enlightenment. Their bed consists of the four contemplations, and its spread is the pure livelihood. And their awakening consists of gnosis, which is constant learning and meditation. Their food is the ambrosia of the teachings, and their drink is the juice of liberation. Their bath is pure aspiration, and morality their unguent and perfume. Having conquered the enemy passions, they are the invincible heroes. Having subdued the four Maras, they raise their standard on the field of enlightenment. In this way, we come to Chapter 9, the Dharma Door of Non-Duality. The structure of this chapter is very simple. Vimalakirti asks the Bodhisattvas a question, to which 31 of them in turn give answers. The same question is then put by the Bodhisattvas to Manjushri, and by Manjushri to Vimalakirti, and each of them answers it in his own way. The question Vimalakirti asks is, please explain how the Bodhisattvas enter the Dharma door of non-duality. Now, what kind of question is this? To begin with, what is meant by the expression Dharma door? It is a term which occurs frequently in Mahayana texts. Dharma Mukha is the Sanskrit expression. In this context, Dharma has its usual meaning, the teaching or the doctrine of the Buddha, and Mukha is door, entrance, opening, or mouth. The Dharma is a door in the sense that it is a means of access to the ultimate truth, to the experience of enlightenment. But a door, any door, has a twofold function. It can open into something, but it can also shut something out. In the same way, the Dharma is a means of entrance into ultimate truth when it is approached as a means to an end. But it shuts you out from ultimate truth when it is taken as an end in itself. If you regard it as an end in itself, the door, or what should have been the door, becomes just part of the wall. You may even forget that it was ever meant for going through. Furthermore, the word Dharma itself has a double meaning. As well as mean the teaching or doctrine, it also means the truth or reality indicated by that teaching or doctrine. So the Dharma is the door to the Dharma. The Dharma as teaching is the door to the Dharma as reality, provided it is not taken as an end in itself. To return to Vimalakirti's question, how do the Bodhisattvas enter the Dharma door of non-duality? What is the Bodhisattva's Dharma door of non-duality? The Dharma as teaching or doctrine is expressed in concepts, and every concept you can think of has an opposite. If there is truth, there must be falsehood. If there is brightness, there must be darkness. The Dharma is therefore always expressed, whether explicitly or implicitly, in terms of pairs of opposites, that is, in terms of duality. The Yogacara, a philosophical school of Mahayana Buddhism, offers a reason for this. It says that concepts are the creation of the Klishto Manovijnana, or defiled mind consciousness, which sees everything, even reality itself, in terms of pairs of opposites. But in the experience of reality, all duality is transcended, even the duality between duality and non-duality. Reality is advaya, non-dual. In reality, duality is not obliterated, one is not left with a blank featureless unity, for there can be no question of obliterating something which in reality does not exist. We ourselves are creatures of duality. Our consciousness is dualistic. Our experience is dualistic. Our thoughts, words, and deeds are dualistic. Our understanding and practice of the Dharma is dualistic. The Dharma itself is expressed in terms of concepts which are pairs of opposites, skillful and unskillful, mundane and transcendental, conditioned and unconditioned, bondage and liberation, defilement and purity. We have to use dualistic expressions as a means of realizing non-dual reality. We have no alternative. And in fact it works, because in reality there is no absolute duality between duality and non-duality. If this were not true, no emancipation would be possible. But how, in practice, can we realize non-duality by means of the dualistic? This is what Brahmakirti is getting at in his question to the Bodhisattvas. How do the Bodhisattvas make a dualistic Dharma function in a non-dualistic way? Being themselves riddled with dualism, how do they follow the way of non-duality? It's a good question, and the Bodhisattvas, one by one, set about answering it. Each Bodhisattva, speaking from his own point of view, states a pair of opposites, a duality, and then shows how, by means of the contradictions inherent in it, that duality can be transcended in terms of itself. For example, the Bodhisattva Bhadrajyotis says, "Distraction and attention are two. When there is no distraction, there will be no attention, no mentation, and no mental intensity." Thus, the absence of mental intensity is the entrance into non-duality. This is Thurman's translation. Lamott's version makes the meaning a little clearer. Distraction and attention are two. If there is no distraction, there is neither attention, nor reflection, nor interest. This absence of interest is the entry into non-duality. The word used for distraction is viksepa, which means distraction in the sense of floundering, the floundering, the tossing, the wandering of the mind. And the word for attention is manyana, in the sense of paying attention. We could also perhaps render the word as concentration, but it's not quite the same thing. Manyana is more like what makes concentration possible. This pair of opposites is experienced especially within the context of meditation, as anybody who practices meditation knows very well. What usually happens is that we begin by paying attention to our object of concentration, breath, mantra, whatever it may be. But after a while, the mind gets restless. It feels uncomfortable and starts to wander. Sooner or later, we become aware of what has happened, what is happening, and we start paying attention again. In this way, we oscillate between the two, distraction and attention, distraction and attention. This is how our meditation proceeds. If we are to learn to concentrate in meditation, we will have to find the doorway to non-duality. We have to question the very terms of the situation, or rather, question the absoluteness of those terms. We have to realize that it is not enough to try to sustain attention by means of a forcible act of will. If distractions persistently arise when we are meditating, we have not understood ourselves deeply enough. There are psychological factors at work within us of which we are not conscious. We need, therefore, to become conscious of them, to take them into consideration, in a word, to become more integrated. When we are more integrated, the different elements of our being will no longer be in conflict with one another, and we will no longer have to oscillate between them, because they will all pull in the same direction. So in the case of distraction and attention, integration is the entry into non-duality. Integration within the context of meditation practice is not synonymous with the experience of non-duality in the highest sense, but it is certainly a step in that direction. This does not mean that we should never try to concentrate, never try to get rid of distractions. That may be necessary as a provisional measure. In fact, it almost certainly will be. And some meditation practices, the mindfulness of breathing, for example, have an integrating effect. But in the long run, the opposition between distraction and attention, which plagues so much of our meditation practice, can only be resolved if we become more psychologically and emotionally integrated. Let's take another example. The Bodhisattva Subahu declares, "Bodhisattva spirit and disciple spirit are two. When both are seen to resemble an illusory spirit, there is no Bodhisattva spirit, nor any disciple spirit. Thus, the sameness of natures of spirits is the entrance into non-duality." Here, spirit does not mean ghost. It translates the Sanskrit chitta and means something like mental attitude. Again, Lamotte's translation is clearer. Bodhisattva mind and listener mind are two. If it is seen that these two minds are the same as an illusory mind, there is neither Bodhisattva mind nor listener mind. This sameness of the mark of minds is the entry into non-duality. Illusory spirit, or illusory mind, Mahachitta in Sanskrit, is not a mind that is absolutely non-existent, but rather a mind that, like the magical show, cannot be defined in terms of existence or non-existence. It is a relatively real mind which has a relatively real existence and which sees things in a relatively real way. It corresponds roughly to the Klishto Manovijnana, or defiled mind consciousness of the Yogacara, which sees things in terms of pairs of mutually exclusive opposites, self and other, good and bad, pure and impure, and so on. One of these pairs of apparent opposites is gaining emancipation for oneself alone, or gaining emancipation for others. If the illusory mind identifies itself with the latter, it becomes the Bodhisattva mind. If it identifies itself with the former, it becomes the Shravaka mind, the listener or disciple mind. But this distinction is ultimately unreal. You cannot progress spiritually yourself without paying attention to the needs of others, without developing friendliness and compassion. And you cannot help others to progress spiritually unless you have made some progress yourself. The Bodhisattva mind and disciple mind, Bodhisattva ideal and Arhat ideal, are not mutually exclusive. The Mahayana and the Hinayana are not mutually exclusive. Both are products of the illusory, relative, dualistic mind, and both represent attempts on the part of this mind to apprehend the nature of the non-dual spiritual ideal. If we understand the limitations of that mind, we will understand the limitations of Bodhisattva mind and disciple mind considered as mutually exclusive. The realization that Bodhisattva mind and disciple mind are both the same as illusory mind is the Dharma door to non-duality. When we use terms like Bodhisattva ideal and Arhant ideal, we must realize that they have only a relative validity. They are not ends in themselves. Their function is simply to help us grow. Next, we'll examine a reply concerned with the concept of sin. The Bodhisattva Singha says, "Sinfulness and sinlessness are two. By means of the diamond-like wisdom that pierces to the quick, not to be bound or liberated is the entrance into non-duality." The word translated as sinfulness is savagya. Lamotte translates it as blame, which is more literal. So who blames us? Who says we are sinful? It could be the group, it could be an individual. Let's say it is the group. When we feel blamed by the group, especially our own group, the group to which we feel we belong, we feel very wretched and miserable indeed. We may be ready to do almost anything to recapture the group's approval. We are completely at its mercy. The opposites here are praise and blame. We swing between elation when we are not blamed and wretchedness when we are. The situation becomes even worse when God comes into it. Then we may be found not just blamable, but actually sinful. But we won't go into all that now. It is too horrible even to think about. What we need to do is find out how to escape the oscillation between praise and blame. The door to non-duality in this case is the development of transcendental individuality, an individuality which is not at the mercy of the group, which is in a sense indifferent to the opinion of the group. It is difficult enough to develop ordinary individuality. Transcendental individuality can be developed only by means of wisdom, the transcendental wisdom that cuts like a diamond, that sees through the power of the group. Ordinary mundane wisdom is not enough. The impact of the group on the individual is strong and persistent, and we cannot help weakening, even giving in sometimes. Only transcendental individuality is strong enough to resist the pressure, to remain unaffected by the group's opinion. This is quite a sobering thought. It means that until we have entered the stream, for only then does transcendental individuality begin to develop, we shall continue to swing between praise and blame, between elation and wretchedness, at least to some extent. No doubt other, more metaphysical interpretations of Singha's declaration are possible, but this one seems particularly appropriate to us. And we need not be afraid to place our own interpretations on traditional texts. When told that a rival saint had interpreted a passage in the Bible differently from himself, Saint Augustine apparently said calmly, "The more interpretations, the better." This has always been the view of the Buddhist tradition towards its scriptures: the more interpretations, the better. I might note in passing, however, that this has not always or even usually been the view of the Christian tradition, where differences in interpretation have frequently been the cause of very bitter, even vicious, disputes and persecution. To take a fourth and last example, let's look at the declaration of the Bodhisattva Shantendriya. He says, "It is dualistic to say Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. The Dharma is itself the nature of the Buddha. The Sangha is itself the nature of the Dharma. And all of them are uncompounded, or, as it is more usually expressed, unconditioned." The uncompounded is infinite space, and the processes of all things are equivalent to infinite space. Adjustment to this is the entry into non-duality. Here we have two pairs of opposites, Buddha and Dharma, Dharma and Sangha. Dharma, the term the two pairs have in common, is here to be taken in the more metaphysical sense, not the Buddha's teaching as expressed in words and concepts, but the ultimate reality of which that teaching is the expression and towards which it points. By virtue of his enlightenment experience, the Buddha is the living embodiment of the Dharma in this sense. So, as Shantendriya declares, there is no duality between Dharma and Buddha. We find something similar in the case of the Sangha, that is the Arya Sangha, the spiritual community of bodhisattvas, arhants, non-returners, once-returners, and stream entrants. All of them are following the transcendental path, so all of them stand in some relation to the unconditioned, some nearer, some further away. In some cases, they have actually reached it. This means that in principle, there is no duality between the Dharma and the Sangha. And if there is no difference between the Buddha and the Dharma, and no difference between the Dharma and the Sangha, there can be no difference between the Buddha and the Sangha. All three essentially are the unconditioned. The Dharma is the unconditioned itself. The Buddha is the unconditioned as fully realized by the individual. And the Sangha is the unconditioned in process of realization. So in the case of the two pairs of opposites which make up the three jewels, the entry into non-duality is the realization that the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha are essentially unconditioned. So long as we see them as conditioned, we see them as three, but when we see them as unconditioned, we see them as one. From this point of view, when we go for refuge to the three jewels, we commit ourselves not to three different things, but to one unconditioned, non-dual, ultimate reality. Now, all this may sound rather metaphysical, not to say abstract, although these four examples are among the simpler, less metaphysical of the Bodhisattva's replies to Vimalakirti's question. But the general drift is clear enough. Dualities, pairs of opposites, including those pairs of opposites which are the doctrinal categories of Buddhism itself, are created by the mind. One enters the Dharma door of non-duality when one realizes that all pairs of opposites are created by the mind and that they are therefore not ultimately valid. They are not ends in themselves, but means to an end, means to the spiritual development of the individual. Moreover, any pair of opposites whatsoever can be a Dharma door to non-duality. Duality itself is the means to non-duality, because the duality between duality and non-duality is not ultimate. This is still, it must be admitted, very much in the realm of the metaphysical, but we can apply the same principle on a much more down-to-earth level and come up with our own dualities. Here are a few to begin with. They are certainly not so sublime as those of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, but no doubt they come somewhat closer to our own experience, and as such, they may be more useful. They may not carry us as far into the depths of non-duality, but at least they will help us to move in that direction from where we are now. Masculine and feminine are two. Individuality is the entrance into non-duality. Organizer and organized are two. Cooperation is the entrance into non-duality. Teacher and taught are two. Communication is the entrance into non-duality. God and man are two. Blasphemy is the entrance into non-duality. Male and female are two. Celibacy is the entrance into non-duality. Individual and group are two. The spiritual community is the entrance into non-duality. These are just a few suggestions, No doubt there are many more such dualities to be reflected on. But it is possible to go even further than seeking the entrance to non-duality in any pair of opposites, as Manjushri's reply to Vimalakirti's question shows. He says, "Good sirs, you have all spoken well. Nevertheless, all your explanations are themselves dualistic. To know no one teaching, to express nothing, to say nothing, to explain nothing, to announce nothing, to indicate nothing, and to designate nothing, that is the entrance into non-duality." Manjushri means that the Bodhisattva's explanations are dualistic because they are all expressed in terms of concepts, which are essentially dualistic. We cannot explain the Bodhisattva's entry into non-duality by means of concepts. To explain it, we have to give up concepts altogether. We cannot, therefore, rely on words to explain non-duality. The only thing we can do is remain completely silent. But to explain this, Manjushri himself has resorted to speech. He has said that silence is the Bodhisattva's entry into non-duality. So Manjushri's explanation itself is not entirely free from duality. There is still one more step to be taken, and Vimalakirti takes it. Then the Crown Prince Manjushri said to the Lichavi Vimalakirti, "We have all given our own teachings, noble sir. Now may you elucidate the teaching of the entrance into the principle of non-duality." Thereupon the Lichavi Vimalakirti kept his silence, saying nothing at all. Vimalakirti remains completely silent. He puts into actual practice what Manjushri has only expressed in terms of concepts. This is the famous thunder-like silence of Vimalakirti, the silence that is more powerful, more expressive than any words. And it represents not only the climax of the chapter, but surely the climax of the entire Vimalakirti Nidesha. But is not Vimalakirti's reply also dualistic? Speech and silence are opposites. To explain the Bodhisattva's entry into non-duality in terms of silence is therefore surely as dualistic as explaining it in terms of speech. What is the entry into non-duality here? The answer is that Vimalakirti does not have a concept of silence. He acts spontaneously according to the circumstances. That is why his silence here is meaningful. After all, there is silence and silence. In chapters 3 and 4, the Arhants and Bodhisattvas were reduced to silence when they encountered Vimalakirti. In chapter 8, Shariputta was reduced to silence by the goddess. But theirs was the silence of stupefaction. Vimalakirti's is the silence of understanding, the silence of enlightenment. Vimalakirti uses silence, but he has no concept of using it. He uses it as a means to an end, to communicate, but he also uses speech wherever necessary. He does not stick to silence. In fact, in the course of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, he says rather a lot. And speech and silence are not his only means of communication. He communicates also through marvellous magical displays. The means of communication are, in fact, infinite, as we shall see in the next chapter.